Our first presentation is from Mark Sternman, and anybody who's done Mark has done reviews for the Dead Ball Era Journal, so thank you for that, Mark. That's the main thing I wanted to say, but Mark's a great scholar, and I always really enjoy reading his reviews. Very insightful guy, and so Mark lives just outside of Boston and works as a staff member for a Massachusetts state senator. He wrote The Last Best Day when Chicago had three first place teams for the online version of the National Pastime Baseball in Chicago, the publication for the 2015 convention. So with that, Mark, it's all yours.
Thanks, Dan, for that generous introduction. It's great to be here. Great to see so many fellow dead ballers. And also want to thank John in absentia, but they've obviously got a great pitch hitter. This is my fourth crack at Tenney for Sabre, so hopefully I'll get it right this time. I wrote about him for the Dead Ball Stars of the NL book. I wrote about him for the Bio Project. I wrote about him for the Boston Bean Eaters book, four different versions. This is the fourth. Today I'm just going to talk mostly about his defensive side of his game. I'll do a brief review of his career and then compare him to some other players. The most common comparison that he used after his career was over to Hal Chase, who in a preceding presentation was aptly described as shady. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Just some basic data from the Sporting News contract card that's available on the Sabre website, in case folks here don't know who Tenney is. I would argue the most influential person in Tenney's career, appropriate to talk about him here in Chicago, was Frank Salee, who managed Tenney in Boston and then moved on to Chicago, where he also managed another first baseman of some note. Salee called up Tenney when the Boston team had some injuries to his catchers, and Tenney was probably the best amateur player nearby. Tenney came up and caught. That worked out temporarily, and then he moved him to the outfield. Salee didn't really like him in the outfield, so he pushed him to first base, which is where Tenney spent the majority of his career. And Tenney, who wasn't a particularly humble person, though I would argue maybe too humble about some parts of his game, was very generous in crediting Salee. Tenney had an interesting style as he played first base. You'll see the quotation talking about him reaching for the ball and playing far from the bag, so far from the bag in this baseball card, we don't even see a bag in evidence. You'll also note his name is misspelled on the card, something that plagued him throughout his career, missing the E in his last name. But a nice little drawing, and he was the originator, we'll get to this, the 3-6-3 double play. The first one he turned with his longtime shortstop counterpart, Herman Long, pictured here before he was with Boston. Claude Ritchie was the victim, the base runner. The cartoon is from the Boston Globe. It's a later cartoon. Tenney, you know, talked about when the DP happened, at first nobody realized what was going on, and then everyone got it, and they thought it was really cool, and they went crazy. One of the fun things about doing baseball research on the same person over time is even someone as long gone as Tenney, you see new stuff about him. The Bill James quote talked about the Fred Tenney, Jake Beckley era. I would argue Tenney was a significant player. I'm not sure he's significant enough to have an era, even if you think an era is 3 years. But it's a nice little compliment for him. Get back to Frank Salee now. After Salee left Boston, he went to Chicago, where for a time he managed Frank Chance before Chance took over. And Salee understandably liked his current player better than his former player, but still had nice things to say about his former player. And I think that was probably a judgment that was fair both objectively and subjectively. Researching dead ball era players, one of the fun parts is seeing the graphics in the newspaper, and the Globe had a very entertaining cartoonist too. These are just some, you know, when I first did the research on Tenney, it was before the Globe was online, so I spent a lot of time looking at microfilm, and happily I saved all the copies I made, so I was able to find these pretty easily. And just some of the entertaining descriptions of Tenney making various defensive plays over a three-year period. The Boston teams from 1904 to 1906 in the National League were terrible, but the drawings in the newspaper at least were great. Tenney had mostly good moments, but had some bad moments too. Here's another card with his name misspelled, and I'm using that to illustrate a game where he made what we thought, at least when I wrote one of these versions, was 4 errors in a game, 3 errors in one inning. I've since been in touch with RetroSheet that is going to look at the game and decide if it's really 4-3. We're not really sure if it's 4-3, though. If you look at the graphic, 3 of the balls hit off his glove and 1 goes right by him, so maybe that was the 4th. Tenney, after a tough time in Boston, was traded to New York for the infamous 1908 season. One of the first, perhaps, in long histories of players losing in Boston, going to winning teams in New York. And though I live in Boston, I'm a Yankees fan, so I try and get these comments in whenever I can when I'm out in Boston. Tenney played great. It was a late career one-year revival for him in 1908. He saved his third baseman, Arthur Devlin, pictured here, a lot of throwing errors. Tenney was really durable here at the end of his career, and people may remember that Tenney missed one game in 1908, but what a game he missed. He missed a game that was the most famous game in the dead ball era, one of the most famous, if not the most famous game ever, what ended up being the 1-1 tie, which maybe people would have forgotten had the regular season not ended in a tie and the playoff game had to happen. And the Cubs beat the Giants. There were different explanations of why Tenney missed the game, but he was certainly near the end of his career and he was doubtless beat up. And too bad for him, too bad for the Giants, most of all, worst of all, too bad for Fred Merkle. There are other famous instances of New York first baseman missing a single game and changing the course of history. Referring, of course, to Wally Pipp and his headache yielding to Lou Gehrig, not for one game, but for 2,130 games, for which I'm grateful as a Yankee fan. But, it's a tough legacy for Mr. Pipp, who is actually a pretty good player. It's interesting to think about the four of them. Obviously, Gehrig's the biggest winner with all of his World Series wins, but Merkle's known for the Merkle boner. Pipp's known for the headache. Gehrig, around this time of year, is remembered for ALS, sadly. My uncle died of ALS, so it's something I think a lot about. Tenney, to the extent he's remembered, isn't associated with any of these things. So just an interesting little side note. All right, now on to the comparative parts. Tenney, at the end of his career, when people would talk to him, they said, oh, you're great, the greatest defensive first baseman ever. And Tenney would sort of, humbly thank them and say, but we all know that I was no Hal Chase. Hal Chase was the greatest ever. And Chase was certainly a stylistic player. Tenney said, and when you look at the data, statistically at least, and some of the standard statistics, Tenney way outshone Chase and set records that lasted for almost till the end of his life. Mickey Vernon broke his assist record in 1949, just a few years before Tenney died. I would argue a better match for Tenney rather than Hal Chase would be Stuffy McGinnis. They had very similar statistics in terms of this traditional baseball statistics. I've also included range factor per game. They were both known as classy team players, and they were both terrible managers. So I think, at the time, I'm sure comparing someone to Hal Chase was a wonderful compliment. People seem to overlook the shady parts of his career. I think at least, at this great distance, a better comparison would be Stuffy McGinnis. Diving a little bit into more sophisticated defensive stats for first base, the total zone numbers are pretty interesting. The highlighted portions are the 4 years where Tenney led the majors in total zone, including, again, that renaissance year in New York in 1908. Career-wise, Tenney stacks up extremely well all-time, 4th all-time. McGinnis also does extremely well, 23rd all-time. And right near the bottom of the list is our friend Hal Chase. Finally, it's kind of amazing that Tenney is still, his memory is still alive today. I quote a poem from the New York Times that was written for whatever reason long after his career ended. You don't see too much poetry in sports sections today. And frankly, having spent some time looking around Chicago earlier today, it's even hard to find the New York Times sometimes today. That being said, Tenney next month in Atlanta is inducted into the Atlanta Baseball Hall of Fame. The Atlanta Braves Baseball Hall of Fame, which is a pretty cool thing for them to do to recognize what I think it's safe to say is the greatest defensive first baseman in Braves franchise history that spans 3 cities, but I can't imagine too many people at the game, I hope I'm wrong, will have any idea who Fred Tenney is. So In conclusion, Tenney died 71 years ago Monday, but in some respects, his memory still lives on, and it's been a pleasure exploring him for the fourth time with all of you. Thanks very much. Well, I mean, the question was, if I can paraphrase, why did McGraw make the trade, the big trade between Boston and New York after the 1907, before the 1908 season? You know, Dan McGann was the first baseman that was traded, and McGann's career ended, you know, I think the next year. So it was certainly an upgrade at first base. I don't know much about McGann's leadership qualities. Tenney, in spite of having a very unsuccessful record both before and after the trade, in Boston, I think, was thought of as a leader on the field, something I assume there are better John McGraw scholars here than I, but something I'm sure McGraw valued. Finally, just an interesting footnote to the trade. Tenney actually had a small ownership share in the Boston team, which he had to sell before the trade went through, so it complicated it. It was obviously a good trade. Tenney was, you know, didn't have a lot left in his career, but had more left than McGann. Dolan was a great player, but his career was pretty much over too. So a bunch of guys traded sides, but really Tenney was the only one who had much left on the field.
You said that, I think on one of the slides about first base from the era were considered fast and agile. Was that a prototypical first baseman for that era before they became kind of in the modern era, the big boppers were first basemen?
You know, there were certainly some first basemen who were more power hitters, at least in terms of the day, like Tim Jordan of Brooklyn. But yes, there weren't really a lot of power hitters anywhere during the dead ball era, so speed was valued more then. And I didn't talk about Tenney's base running, but he was a pretty good base steal. All right. Thanks, everybody.
So the next thing on the agenda is the presentation of the Ritter Award, which is always really exciting. So I think everybody knows that it was won by Jason Cannon for his book Charlie Murphy. And there's a whole lot of really nice things said by the judges in the newsletter, if you guys read all the nice things said about him. But I'm going to read something else that had nothing to do with the judges. It was the best blurb on the back of his book. So here's the best blurb from the back of his book. Over the first couple of decades of the 20th century, Cubs owner and general manager Charles Murphy was as significant as any executive in baseball and one of its most interesting characters. Jason Cannon perceptibly unwraps the man who oversaw Cubs championship seasons and was a principal actor in some of the era's most notable controversies and boardroom battles. And just as an aside, the author of that blurb was me. So with that, Jason, come on up and grab your award. We'll get the handshake here for Dixie.
Tenney could hear better than Chance, I'll say that much. Evers used to joke that he would walk by one side of Chance and say terrible things about him, but Chance couldn't hear out of that ear, so he was good to go. Special thank you to Dan. I appreciate the kind introduction. God bless me with a few people to thank. I'll do it quick and then get to some comments about old Charles Murphy. My wife, Reagan, was pretty patient and let me work on this for 4.5 years, so I want to give her a shout out. I want to say a special thank you to the Dead Ball Era Committee and those of you who are here in attendance today. Thank you to Sabre, very kind to honor this book with this award, and also to Mr. Ritter, whose work set an incredible standard that I will never meet, but we can try. I can try. Jack Bales was very influential throughout this entire process, and I bounced a lot of ideas off of him. His influence is all over this thing. As is Dan's, he sent me letters I couldn't find. A lot of people really helped, and so I'm very appreciative to everyone. And also the Cubs. The Cubs organization, when they found out about this project, they wanted as much info as I could supply them, so I sent them everything I had, and they were thrilled to get it. So we built a really good relationship and had an event at Wrigley last year, and it led directly to the project I'm working on now, which is a book on Billy Williams and Willie McCovey, who grew up about 3 miles apart. So special thanks to the Cubs. Charlie Murphy, he has an American life story that so many of us like to tell and so many of us like to hear. His parents were Irish immigrants, and Murphy grew up very poor in rural Ohio, about an hour northeast of Cincinnati. His father struggled with alcohol, and so he had to work at a young age, about 15, to help his mother pay the bills. So how does Murphy go from being a drug clerk on Main Street in Wilmington, Ohio, to owning the Chicago Cubs? Well, some of you may know, but for those of you who may not, or if you know, you're partway through and then fell asleep, sorry about that. But it's really quite a story. He decided that he wanted to be a journalist, and so he moved to Cincinnati, where he was eventually hired by Charles Taft, who owned the Cincinnati Times-Star. And in the course of working for Taft at the Times-Star, he caught the attention of John T. Brush. Now, John T. Brush was about as friendly as, you know, a pit bull who's just been shot with a pellet gun. And yet, Murphy weaseled his way into Brush's heart. Brush was amused by Murphy. He was entertained by Murphy. Murphy would really prioritize covering baseball in the offseason. He did not want to give the headlines to college football. Why are we doing that? People want to read about baseball. Let's do it. So he would travel to the winter meetings. And when the owners would be huddled together in a ballroom, maybe something like this, he would bang on the door and say, "All right, you've had plenty of time to talk. Now tell us, the reporters, what it is that you've been talking about." And they occasionally would share a little bit with him, and then President Nick Young finally said, "Go talk to this guy, he's driving us crazy." When they wouldn't talk to him, Murphy would gather all the reporters at the bar downstairs, and he would say, "All right, they're not going to tell us what they're doing. We'll make it up. No one will know the difference." So you have a guy who was really inventive, imaginative, and creative when it came to covering the game. And Brush grew to appreciate it. So in 1905, Brush, now owning the New York Giants, hires Charlie Murphy to be really the first public relations man in the history of baseball. And the way that it worked was Murphy would travel ahead of the team to promote the upcoming series in local papers and in the papers back in New York. And the writers in New York hated him for this, of course. But as he's traveling in 1905, he's in Chicago, he's here in town, and he meets with Jim Hart, who at the time was the president of the Cubs. And he's talking to Jim, "Jimmy, what's going on?" And Jim says, "Oh man, it's crazy around here. Old John Walsh, who owns the team, he's under investigation by the feds. He needs liquidity and he needs it quickly because he's got a lawyer up. We think the team's going to be put up for sale." And Charlie, who knew a thing or two about baseball, he loved it growing up. He played it a lot. He hung out with McGraw a lot when he was in New York. Spent a lot of time picking McGraw's brain about how he set his roster, configured his team. Murphy recognized the young talent on the field and he got an idea. He said, "How much is the team going to be for sale?" "Four. What's the cost?" And Hart replied, "About $100,000. And Murphy said, "This is a deal of a lifetime." He said, "Can I get a 3-4 day option to buy the team if I promise to pay that full price?" Hart says, "Sure." Murphy hops on the first train to Cincinnati, bangs on his old boss's door. Charles Taft says, "Hey, it's good to see you, but why are you here?" He says, "I need $100,000. "What do you need $100,000 for?" "We're going to buy the Cubs." And Charles Taft was very conservative with his money. He's not so sure. He sends one of his guys up to Chicago to check it out. Charlie goes we got to decide quickly. Taft says, give me 24 hours. His guy comes back, everything checked out, loans him the money. They buy the team $100,000. Jim Hart finishes out the year 1905. Salih's sick, so the interim manager, Frank Chance, is installed. After the season end, Hart retires, Murphy's elevated to president, and he decides that Chance is going to have the interim tag removed. He's going to become the permanent manager of Chicago Cubs. So there you go. If any of us want to become owner of a Major League Baseball team, that's the formula to follow. So pretty amazing to think about the story of Murphy. And I was surprised that it hadn't really been written about before, and I was thrilled to be able to uncover it. So just a quick word about some of the research. I don't know what the sense is you guys have, but the sense I got in studying this project, it was fascinating to talk to people, and with few exceptions in terms of historians or some of us working on it, in kind of that realm of popular culture, the Cubs don't really seem to exist before Wrigley Field. I'm talking about popular culture, not in this room. And everything's tied to the ballpark. So everything pre-Wrigley is kind of like another world. And I was fascinated by that dynamic. So they played at the Westside Grounds, which is now Illinois Medical Center. Murphy eventually sold that land later on in his life. And so it was this whole new world opened up on the west side of town. And so in the Chicago History Museum, they had a bevy of photographs and wonderful images, but not a lot of documentation. Murphy didn't have any kids. All his papers vanished, they're gone, no one knows where they are. His great-grandniece, Amy Asbach, and I talked a good number of times over the course of this project. You might know her from Wings. She's John Ritter's widow. And she and I had a great number of conversations about her family history. No one knows where the papers are. So this was kind of a tough project to get going, but everything changed when I visited a couple places. Number one, Cincinnati History Museum, as well as Cooperstown. In Cincinnati, you have all of the Taft financial entries, Annie Taft's journals and her diaries. And it took us a while to find it, but we finally found all the financial transactions that had to do with the Cubs during the Taft's tenure as partners with Murphy. The second thing was the Gary Herman papers in Cooperstown. I don't know if Herman was ever diagnosed as OCD, but shout out to Gary, because that dude kept every carbon copy of everything, both as a, when he was the president of the Reds and when he was on the National Commission. And so I got love for Herman, because that's he's the only reason this project even happened, because every letter that Murphy wrote to him or that he, every fine he issued to Murphy, they were in there. And so that's what allowed the project to move forward. So that was exciting. One of the things that I think is important to share in terms of Murphy's story, how was he an innovator? And how did those papers demonstrate that he was an innovator? I'll give you one example. There was a large discussion in the National Commission about changing the World Series from a seven-game series to a nine-game series. And this happened, interestingly enough, this proposal was put forward by Charlie, and it was after the Cubs lost as overwhelming favorites to the White Sox in 1906. The hitless wonders got him. And he and Comiskey had a great relationship. They laughed about it a lot, but Murphy burned. He was not real thrilled. So his solution was, the easiest way for us to avoid upsets in the future is to lengthen the series. Well, it was also a money-making proposal that every owner agreed with Murphy. This could work. There was only one owner who was against it, Comiskey. And Murphy went, oh, man, all right. And Murphy gave up the fight because Comiskey was against it. He respected Comiskey that much. Might have been the only guy he respected enough to kind of call off the dogs about one of his proposals for. Another proposal that didn't quite work, he wanted to put numbers on the back of uniforms, but he told Francis Richter of the Sporting News, I forgot. One of the really interesting things is the way Murphy was ousted, as I've got a few minutes left just to have some concluding thoughts. Most of you probably know the story. In 1914, Murphy and Johnny Evers are at a loggerheads. They're not getting along. Murphy wants to fire Evers and hire Hank O'Day, the former umpire, who also, you know, had some experience. But this is a very controversial move. But by firing Evers, he would have left the National League susceptible to the Federal League moving in and signing Evers. So this was an issue that the other owners couldn't tolerate. So they had argued over the years. Murphy hated Van Johnson and picked fights with Van Johnson whenever he could. Wasn't afraid of him. Why? Because they had known each other since they were in their 20s, both living and riding in Cincinnati. He didn't care, wasn't intimidated. So they kind of put up with him, the other NL owners, because Murphy could be their pit bull. But this grievance was too much. They couldn't afford to risk losing Johnny to the Federal League. And so the other owners got together. They called Charles Taft and said, hey, this is it. We got to get rid of this guy because of this competition issue. Taft didn't want to do it. Initially, he said no, but he gave way after a while, and Murphy was forced out. My favorite part of this entire story is that a few months later, when dialogue starts to heat up between Taft and Charlie Wiegman, there's a problem, and that is that they realize that Murphy's still the primary stockholder. No one's bought him out. So Murphy actually still owns and controls the team, and he does for a while after that, maybe about 18 months. So he actually became a hero on the West Side because they wanted to move the team to the North Side, obviously, as they're building the Federal League Park. And Murphy said, no, you can't do it. I actually still own the team. And that was news to everybody except for him. They thought that it had been resolved. When Murphy was out of baseball, he went back home and he built a theater. You could still go to a show there today. The Murphy Theater on Main Street in Wilmington, still around. Check it out. But it's one of these stories that's hard to believe and you'll never see repeated. After he was done building the theater, he stayed in the game. You could see him at Wrigley Field quite a bit. He still rooted for the Cubs. In fact, there are stories about him having to leave home to get back to Chicago to go watch his beloved Cubs play. So it was never personal with him. It was all always business. So the last thing that I just want to share with you is that between 1906 and 1910, as most of you well know, but just to reiterate, the Cubs won over 500 games. The core of those teams, the 500 win club, four pennants, two World Series, and I look forward to the day when Charles Webb Murphy is inaugurated into the Cubs Hall of Fame because he is the most successful owner in the history of the franchise. Thank you for your time. Yeah.
I'm just one. Hi. Good job. Thank you for the presentation.
Yeah.
Did you happen to know how much Murphy was bought out for?
The number was in the $400,000 range, but there's multiple payments. There's multiple payments after the initial sum because there was interest in the contract. So the 450 number is as accurate as we could find. Sarah and I dug through each of Annie Taft's financial record books, and that was the number that came up. So that's where, in terms of the book, where that number
came from.
So he
did pretty well turning $100,000 into $400,000.
Yep. And then he made even more money because he had purchased the land that he ended up selling to the state that became the Illinois Medical Center today. But he made money off the real estate transaction. And there's a whole nother deal with Philadelphia, too, and owning the Baker Bowl and all
he
that
owned
stuff.
He owned the Baker Bowl?
Mm-hmm, with the Tafts. Horace Vogel. It's a hot mess. Trust me, if Murphy could create a problem, he was happy to do it. But they did very well for themselves. Charles, Annie, and Charlie, the three of them, both in Chicago and in Philadelphia, yeah.
And how is A.B. Yasbeck related to him?
She is his great-grandniece.
Great-great-niece. Great-grandniece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for your question. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jason. Again, it's a really fun read, and perfect. It's a perfect dead ball era book. I mean, it's got all the great dead ball era stories. So, our cleanup hitter today, Rob Fitz. Rob is a won the Sabre Research Award for his research on Issei baseball, and today he's going to talk a little bit about Japanese baseball during the dead ball era. Rob's won the Seymour Award for his book on the American Baseball Tour of Japan in 1934 and has all kinds of other great awards and one of baseball's great researchers. So Rob, come on up. And I think he's got some baseball cards he's passing around. Please just take a couple and pass them along. I see Steve's trying to pick out who he wants there, but.
So we don't waste time while he's doing that, I'll start.
We got Trace here to help.
Oh, excellent. Today I'm gonna talk about my book, Issei Baseball. And since we're all baseball researchers here, and most of us are authors, I thought what I'd talk about was the story behind the book. I need presentation mode. It should have the next slide up here, and it should have my notes. So I'm going to talk about some of the sources and how I found them, and then end with a quick overview of Japanese American baseball. Here we go. So I reached out to Japanese American baseball expert Kariyo Nakagawa, and he found this clipping for me. And the newspaper clipping shows that it's a team called the Japanese Baseball Association, or JBBA, that played around 1910. And you'll notice that some of the names, or maybe this won't be terribly interesting to you, but they're very rare Japanese names. There's a name Saisho, a name Kitsuse, and a name Toyo. Now, at that time, I was working on a different project, so I didn't pursue it. I kind of put it off for the side to come back to later. And a few years later, I was working on my biography of Mashi Murakami. And some of you may remember that Mashi was in this room in 2015 to give a presentation. And while I was working on my Mashi book, I wanted to write a chapter about what Japanese had played professionally in the United States before Mashi. And at that time, it was believed that the first professional Japanese player was a fellow named Goro Mikami, who played for the All Nations Barnstorming team in 1914. But as I started to research Mikami for the book, I found out two things. And I had the advantage of using online newspapers, which were not available to previous researchers. So aided by this source, what I found out was, first, there was no evidence that Mikami was ever known as Jack Mikado, like previous researchers had thought. Despite numerous hours searching on newspapers, there's no use of this term found. Second, I found he wasn't even the first player to play on the All Nations. There's another fellow named Naito who played from 1912 to 1914. So now I had to go out and research Naito. Now, unfortunately, Naito is a very common Japanese surname, and I didn't have his first name, so I was unable to identify who this was. But in my searches, I came across a fellow named Naito who played for the 1906 Guy Green's Japanese barnstorming team. Now, a box score I found shows not only Naito, but also the hopefully familiar to you names of Kitsuse and Toyo. And this tied the 1906 team to the 1910 JBBA, or Japanese Baseball Association team. Now at this time, just about nothing were known about these early Japanese American teams. Were these amateur teams, weekend ball players? Were these semi-pro teams, professional barnstorming teams? No one really knew. Where did they learn to play baseball? And how good were they? So, you know, voila, there's my next book, right? I knew this is something that I wanted to really get into. So with these online databases, it really didn't take long. It only took a few weeks for me to have dozens of games researched and at my fingertips. And then I went off to Japan to further do research on these teams and their origins. I tied the names in these box scores in these newspaper articles to biographical information by using census records and immigration records, and also the World War I draft cards. Now, this was often difficult because the Japanese names are usually misspelled in the American official records. And a lot of times, the Japanese immigrants don't even show up at all in census records. Nonetheless, I was able to identify the core players that formed these dead ball era Japanese baseball teams. And you should by now have some of these guys in your hands. So the first is Atsuyoshi Harry Saisho. He was the son of a war hero from the Satsuma Rebellion. And for those of you who know, Satsuma Rebellion is the war that the Tom Cruise movie The Last Samurai is based on. Ken Kitsuse was Saisho's childhood friend and the son of a member of the Japanese parliament. Tozan Matsuko was a reporter. And Tom Ueda was a wealthy son of another member of the Japanese parliament. And that's when this project really started to take off, because I got unbelievably lucky with some sources. So Kerryo Nakagawa introduced me to Saisho's children, who were still alive. And they had family stories, but they also had three absolutely amazing items in their possession. The first were two life histories that were recorded right before Harry died in the 1970s. The second was an account book covering the entire 1911 JBBA tour. And the third was a privately printed amateur history of Japanese-American baseball in California in the dead ball era. Yeah, of course it was in Japanese, so it took a while to translate it, but it's there. Now, Kitsuse is an extremely rare Japanese name, so it really took a matter of moments to find him and his descendants in Google and through census records. And this led me to his grandchildren. The grandchildren not only had family stories, but they had an invaluable resource. These are Ken's baseball photographs that Ken himself tore out of the album so he could fit it in one of the two suitcases he was allowed to bring to him, with him to the relocation camp of Manzanar during World War II. So these images, and there's several dozen of them, are the best source we have for pre-World War I Japanese-American baseball. And this valuable collection is now in the Baseball Hall of Fame at Cooperstown. Now, I was never able to locate the descendants of Tozan Matsuko, but I did come up with two good sources. One was a biographical entry in a 1910 Who's Who among Japanese in the Rocky Mountain region that gave his background. And the other I found on eBay. I found a letter written by Matsuko to a local town team asking for a game. And it was full of information about the team, their roster, and the contract for them to sign. So we have insight on what it was like to host a barnstorming team. Now, Ueda is an extremely common Japanese name. It means the man who lives above the field. And it took me several years to track down Tom and his family. The first problem was Tom went by his English name, Tom, instead of Tetsuboro, which I originally searched for. So he was hard to find. But once I did, I found his family and his only child, his daughter Vivian. But when Vivian gets married, she disappeared from the record, and I couldn't find her for over a year. Until one day when I was extremely bored, and I tried Google yet again. And you know, usually you give up after the fifth page. Well, this time I'm really bored. So I kept on going. And somewhere around the 15th page, I struck gold. I found a salad company webpage. And you can see what's highlighted. Now, this led me to Vivian's sons and Tom's extraordinary story. Tom played baseball in high school in Japan and immigrated to the United States in 1904 with the dreams of becoming a professional baseball player. After playing on Guy Green's team in 1906, he moved to St. Louis and eventually became the manager of the city's most prestigious country club. In 1917, he married Lulu Lamb at a time when marriage between whites and non-whites was illegal in Missouri. So the couple eloped to Chicago to get married. By 1930, Tom had become the most successful Japanese man in St. Louis, and he had this stately home built for him and his family. And he also became an honorary representative of the Japanese Tourist Board. But this fell apart on December 7th, 1941, where he was arrested as a potential spy. He was the perfect target for a very ambitious district attorney who wanted to prove his own patriotism. During a closed-door hearing where Tom was denied a lawyer, he was convicted as a spy and sent to prison for the remainder of the war. He was released in 1945, and the government eventually apologized for the miscarriage of justice. And 10 years later, Vivian marries into the Anheuser-Busch family. And you can see by the genealogy how closely she is to the core of the family. So Tom's family was able to provide me with family pictures, help me contact his relatives in Japan who still live in this house that you see behind me where Tom was born. And his three-inch thick FBI file and court records hold a wealth of information. So, what did I do with all these great sources? So Issei Baseball follows these four players from their childhoods in Japan to their immigration experience to their baseball careers, to their time during World War II, and their eventual death in the United States. And through these four players, I attempt to give a history of Japanese-American baseball during the dead ball era. Now, baseball was introduced in Japan in 1872, more or less, by American teacher Horace Wilson, and it quickly spread among the elite schools in Tokyo and Kobe. First Japanese-American baseball teams were created in 1903 and 1904 in San Francisco and Los Angeles. They started out as pickup games among immigrants who had played baseball in Japan and just wanted to get together to play ball. But within a couple years, they turned into formal amateur teams. Now in 1905 and 1906, things Japanese were really popular in the United States. You have the Mikado, you have Japanese-Russian War, so Japan's in the headlines. So to take advantage of this fad, Guy Green, the owner of the Nebraska Indians, decides to form a barnstorming team of all Japanese players. And Green claimed that he brought these players directly from Japan after scouring, quote, the flowerly nation for its best players. In reality, he went to Los Angeles and recruited these amateur players. On April 15th, 1906, the team played its first game in Frankfort, Nebraska. And that became the first professional baseball game by a Japanese team on either side of the Pacific, because Japanese did not have their first team until the 1920s, first professional team, that is. Teams spent the next 6 months traveling across the Midwest. Team did very well on the diamond. But in October, Green decided to disband the team, and the players went home. But two players decided to organize their own professional barnstorming teams. In 1908, Tozan Masco created the Mikado Baseball Club in Denver, Colorado, with Tom Ueda and his brother Takatomo, and several other local ballplayers. And they planned to barnstorm across the Midwest all the way to the East Coast. Moscow sent these letters that you've already seen to the local clubs asking for their games. The team began with games in Denver before heading east across Colorado, through Kansas, and into Missouri. Now, at that time, anti-Japanese sentiment was really strong, and the teams had to put up with a lot of problems. And this cartoon from a Denver paper just shows some of the ridicule that they put up with. And I get into that a lot in the book of what these teams had to overcome, but I'll just mention it here. So the Mikado played about 30 games in their first month. But then torrential rainstorms flooded the region, making the Diamonds unplayable. And with no income, the team quickly went broke, and they had to return for Denver after only 1 month on the road. So after returning to Los Angeles, Saisho, Kitsusei, and others from Green's team formed an amateur team called the Nanka that played in LA for a couple of seasons. In 1909, Saisho decides it's time to turn the Nanka pro. And he recruited future Japanese Hall of Famer Shin Hashido, who was in California as a reporter. And he changed the team's name to the Japan Baseball Association. The team played three games in Los Angeles as warm-up games. But as you can see, things did not go too well. Hashido quit the team in frustration, and Saisho was forced to cancel the barnstorming team. In 1911, Saisho tried again. This time, he bolstered his team with Native American pitcher William Watkins, who played under the name Naga and pretended to be Japanese. Watkins would go on to pitch for the Nebraska Indians and also a number of seasons in the minor leagues. The JBBA barnstormed for 6 months across eight states, playing 128 games. And the Saisho account book details every single gate receipt and every single expenditure. And as you can see, it includes stops for ice cream and cigarettes. So what an amazing source we now have for studying barnstorming and the economics of barnstorming. So the team was not very talented. They lost almost all their games, as you can see up there, but they were well received. And on August 24th, the account books have a balance of $202.25. But then once again, the rains began. On September 24th, they limp into St. Louis, and they play two final games against the African-American St. Louis Stars. And then they're unable to find further opponents. And you can see they're broke. They have 2 cents left at this point. They have to borrow money for a train ticket back to Los Angeles. Well, sadly, this is the last Japanese professional barnstorming team. You wonder why, right? The players returned to their hometowns and played amateur and semi-pro ball for the rest of their lives. But they did teach the next generation, the Nisei. Now, one thing I want to talk about for a few seconds is most Japanese immigrants at this time wanted to become part of mainstream American society. And they consciously used baseball to build bridges with white Americans, to find a common ground. And what we're seeing here is obviously the modern baseball card some of you have in your hands, but the other one is a cut postcard that Saisho made himself to give out to prospective opponents. And look at the symbolism of this card. He's standing in front of an American flag with his extended hand. He's showing friendship and his desire to be American. Of course, we know this didn't work. During World War II, approximately 120,000 Japanese Americans, including Saisho, Kitsusei, and most of their team members, were forcibly removed from their homes and incarcerated in detention camps. And their baseball became a survival tool, a means to boost morale, and for some people, a reason to stay alive and not give up. And I want to end by saying, if you want to know more about Japanese-American baseball during the war, some great work being done by Sabre members right now. Bill Staples, Charlie Vascolero, and Kerryo Nakagawa have created this traveling exhibit that's going to be at the All-Star Game this year and was at the All-Star Game last year. And that's all I have to present today, but I will gladly take questions about research methods or even Japanese baseball in general, but no Otani questions, please.
Okay, just real quick. The research that I've done for the book that I'm working on came across a team from Waseda University, a college team that came to Monmouth, Illinois and played. It was a big deal. They made quite a bit of the players coming and socializing and winning. What do you know of that particular team?
Waseda came several times. My book has chapters on both the 1905 and 1911 tour. So they're very important, and this team, probably the Greens team, would not have taken off without the Waseda 1905 team. So, okay. I actually never saw the album itself. They were just individual pictures. And because of modern life, I've never met the Kitsuse family face to face. We had many phone calls, we had many emails, but everything was done electronically. So yeah, I never actually saw, I mean, eventually they sent the pictures to me, and so I could scan them for the book and then give them to the Hall of Fame. Oh yeah, they said we have these, you might be interested. You know, maybe you go to like, I'm like, yeah, I think I might, yeah. I'm sorry, the legend? Oh, you, last question. I don't know. Sadly, Saisho's three children, I was in touch with them. They were all in their 90s. And during my research, they passed. And I wasn't close enough to them for their children to know and to reach out to me. And when I finally got in touch with them, no one knew what happened to the, you know, the father's old papers. So I'm afraid the worst happened.